Do you remember the moment you decided to build LifeCheck? Going from your time with Old Mutual, you decided to leave the comfort of that. How did you make that decision?
So there wasn't a moment for LifeCheck, but there was a moment to leave corporate, right? From that to LifeCheck was a little bit of a journey. So the leaving corporate thing, I think the moment was, I had a very senior role. I had a really good career at Old Mutual. I was there for almost 10 years. So we almost died trying to cross that thing. You're like, oh my God, we will never survive getting past this thing. And it nearly almost kills you. And you get to the other side of it and you're like, okay, right. Now I understand why I don't think a sane person should try to do that.
I love it.
What was that moment where you had, okay, so you've helped your sister. This is clearly a gap that exists in the market to productizing it and building a business within the space.
On today's episode, we have an incredible guest. Who's our very first guest building for the South African market. He made a truly unconventional leap from a very senior career in financial risk management to the uncertain world of entrepreneurship. Abu Ade is the founder and CEO of LifeCheck. 10 years ago, LifeCheck was just an idea. He disrupted the existing model, bringing personalized financial planning to everyday people, entrepreneurs, professionals. Abu, welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So let's just get right into it. Do you remember the moment you decided to build LifeCheck? Going from your time with Old Mutual, you decided to leave the comfort of that. What was that moment for you? And how did you make that decision?
So there wasn't a moment for LifeCheck, but there was a moment to leave corporate, right? And then the journey from that to LifeCheck was a little bit of a journey. So the leaving corporate thing, I think the moment was, I had a very senior role. I had a really good career at Old Mutual. I was there for almost 10 years. And I'm a very big mission-oriented person. I think I've involved myself in everything I've done around how do I spend most of my career energy on how to better build a better continent, right? So how to better develop the economic fundamentals of the continent of Africa. So that was a big part of my thinking at the time, but I realized that with the dynamics of where the group was going, that wasn't going to be the most important thing. And it was in a meeting where I was, okay, I think it was a conference call with the guys at Old Mutual PLC. And I was, okay, I have read the memo now.
What was it exactly? Could you share as much as you can in terms of the context of, okay, it's not going to work with this trajectory for me?
So my job there was being responsible for capital allocation for the emerging markets business. So I ran balance sheet management for Old Mutual. And you got to follow the money, right? It was, where is capital being allocated? Where's the money really moving? And it was that moment I realized, I don't really think this is where this is going, right? So that was the beginning of the end, if I can call it that, for me, that journey. It took about a year to leave because it was a very senior role, lots of relationships and lots of people that I loved, worked with, respected and valued, and just took time to just properly separate. I knew I wanted to get involved in financial advice, right? There was an epiphany moment there where my sister asked me to review. She's a doctor. She just recently graduated and I was already working for a while and quite senior. She'd asked me to look at her finances and just her stuff she's gotten from financial advisors and give a second opinion. And I initially ignored it because I'm sure it's professionals, it's fine. Until I looked at it and realized, oh my God, this is really bad. And then I spent 6 hours building a spreadsheet into the depths of the night trying to figure out just how bad the advice was. That's when I knew I wanted to be involved in financial advice. But combining those two epiphanies did not necessarily equal LifeCheck immediately.
So what was that moment where you had, okay, so you've helped your sister. This is clearly a gap that exists in the market, to productizing it and thinking about building a business within the space?
When I left Old Mutual, it was myself and 3 other colleagues the Old Mutual job was my first job, and it was a job to build a division that was very new to the industry at the time. Asset liability management and insurance was a kind of a new topic. So everyone that co-founded LifeCheck were also first people that I hired into Old Mutual at the time. So we just all had worked there for a very long time, knew each other, and we were just thinking about things that we might do. And we all started talking about advice for a while, but whenever we thought of the thing we might work on as a group, that was the thing that just had the most energy from us. So there was that idea, still not, oh, let's go build this advice business at all. It was, okay, that's a cool idea, but there's also other things that we want to explore. And it was probably, we decided that we want to run an experiment in the financial advice space. And that's when we registered what at the time was, so we, the company we set out to explore these ventures was called Convex Financial. Mm-hmm. And because we didn't have a better name, we said, we call it Convex Financial Advice would be this experiment in financial advice. And the experiment was, can we spend time with financial advisors to understand just what the space looks like before we commit to building anything? And we couldn't find any advisors that were that keen to go on this journey of how do you make advice more holistic? How do you make it more better lifestyle financial planning for middle-income customers? They got the idea, they loved the topic, but it was, no, we don't have time to do that. That was a really surprising thing, right? Because you agree the thing is broken, but you don't think it needs to be fixed. That's not the reaction I was expecting. So the four founders were, it was Shen, Dylan, Dave, and myself. And Shen and Dave are technologists, right? And Dylan and I were lecturer people. And we took the unusual step of, Dylan and I are going to register to become financial advisors. And I'm going to go from peak of my career at executive level at the biggest insurer at the time on the continent to being a lowly financial advisor. And I did that for a year, right, with Dylan to deeply understand the space. It was in that journey of, okay, we're doing research, right, really trying to deeply understand this problem. We're also running a couple of other ventures, and there were other ideas for what might become the thing we do. And I think towards the end of, middle of 2016 was when we're, okay, this is the thing we want to do. Is we want to build this advice, this technology-based advice business. And we stopped everything else. And we doubled down on then we needed a name for LifeCheck. So it wasn't LifeCheck at the time, but longer story that we probably don't have time for as to how we came up with it.
We would love to get into it, but I would love to understand, because we have folks who are exploring ideas, how you did, and deciding what evidence or data is enough for them to say, okay, maybe there's something here. It's never going to be perfect or enough, if you see what I mean. So what were the signals that you saw that was, okay, you know what, there's something enough here for me to jump?
So the model, okay, so the moment where I think we had the hypothesis, right, the proper value hypothesis that, okay, there's something here that we might be able to find product market fit down this path is, so we set out, so the reason we became financial advisors, but look, financial plans are just not good, right, for most people. Nobody comes home from a meeting with financial advisor and look at this great plan that I have, right? There's no product of that nature. That it's usually just you sign some plan, right? They're going to take money from your account, or you deposited money in something and it's a fund that's going to go up and down. But there's no financial planning in the sense of, look, you've got to, you want to travel, you want to start a business, you starting a family, you have all these life goals. And here's a plan for financially how these things are going to happen for you that's built around your life goals, right? So we just felt there wasn't such a thing. So the mission was build a better financial plan. And we did that. We iterated among, so I think between Dylan and I, we saw probably about 100 clients.
Wow.
I was a registered advisor. We were doing proper financial plans. Now, when we got to the place where customers were asking us, okay, so how much does this cost? Then was for us, okay, this is, it's clearly good enough. People are expecting to pay for it. That was a moment where, okay, there's something really here. Look, I had the conviction, I think, a bit before that. But that tipping point of people saying, okay, how much do I pay for this? It was really that moment where we're like, okay, cool, this is something we can build.
Yeah. And I guess you were doing that all manually at the time without using tech. So I'm just curious, as you thought about building the company in those early days, how did you think about the balance between building something that's automated, leveraging tech, but also with that human in the loop? I'd love to hear how you thought about that in the early days, and then how that's changed over time. Do you have this AI and ML component, and how have you thought about automating some of those decisions made for customers?
So we always started with the view that, look, okay, in the depth of the night, building that spreadsheet around my sister's financial plan, rather, this is not a simple thing, right? Where even if a person is really skilled, for them to have the spreadsheet skills, that all these goals a person has, there's all this money they have, get it all to work out. It's some modeling required, right? So there was that realizing that there's got to be automation, even if the human's in the loop, because the quality is just not going to be consistent, right, across many people. So the actual guts of advice decisions, we knew enough about the complexity of just interfacing with the insurance industry and long-term savings industry that even if you automated the talking part with the person, the actual part where the rubber hits the road of taking out a policy or putting money away, that's just this messy thing that's almost, outsiders often think that it's deliberately messy so that to keep the cost high, the margins high. But some insurance products, you need to go see a doctor and they need to verify that you're okay. It's a really messy industry. And that part was always going to be a long, hard road of chipping away at efficiency.
The problem. Yeah.
Like, it was never going to be, there's a clever algorithm that just suddenly figures out which insurance company to ping and how to, even if you could, then welcome to the world of the insurance underwriters.
Yeah.
Take this form and join the queue kind of experience, right?
So there were no APIs or anything like that. So you just had to navigate an evolving industry without all of these.
Exactly, right? There's no technology ecosystem around services, right? Around digital services in this space. Not with payments where there was already starting to be banks were allowing you to play in this space. It was a very messy thing. So I think to answer your question of, okay, how did automation play into, came at it from two angles that on the one level, it's the technology problem. And this is where Shen and Dave were brilliant. This boring CRM type of stuff. But then in the middle of all of that, there's this really like special piece, how to make the numbers tell a beautiful human story about a person's financial life, right? Which is a customer experience that is really good that you can automate, right? To generate that experience. So that's one aspect of where we thought we could create real value. And the other aspect was, and this is funny enough, especially in the world of AI and just the cost of building stuff just coming down dramatically, is that abstracting away this complexity of how you interface with all these insurance companies across all these products is one of the really enduring pieces of value that we've been able to create and continue to create, which is you don't need to know how to, some of our insurance partners don't know how to build APIs, don't need to know how to build APIs, but we make it easy to interface with them, right?
Got it. Would you say that became a moat over time? Would you say that became a defensibility that made it harder for folks to enter the market after you?
Look, the first sign of a moat is that you almost die crossing it, right?
It tries to kill you.
If it doesn't try to kill you, then it's probably not a moat, right? So we almost died trying to cross that thing. And that it was, you kind of land in this thing, you're like, oh my God, we will never survive getting past this thing. And it nearly almost kills you. And you get to the other side of it and you're like, okay, right. Now I understand why I don't think a sane person should try to do that. Yeah.
I love it. And I would love to talk about the fundraising piece because it sounds you decided for a while, you had the clarity that you were going to leave corporate, didn't quite know what you were going to do, but then you doubled down on LifeCheck as an idea and explored that 1 year, 2 years after. Now you've left LifeCheck, especially given you left a senior role, which probably came with perks that no longer existed after you left. How did you figure out navigating your personal runway, but then also fundraising for the startup?
So the job we were doing at Old Mutual was basically helping the company at the time when we started building the ALM division, was helping the company navigate the great financial crisis and all the problems with embedded insurance guarantees that many insurers around the world had and the balance sheet risk it created and so on. And Old Mutual was particularly hard hit by that. So we got shares when the share price was 4.50, and then they gave us a lot of shares because we were quite a critical team and all of those sort of things. And so when I left, all four of us at the time, we were all rich because we didn't have kids. So anyone without kids is rich, right? But we had unreasonably well. So we had a decent personal runway to, okay, that's why we could be like, oh, we'll take a year to finish, to figure out what we're going to do.
Okay.
So that's a bit of serious privilege at that moment there. But the other part
of... fundraising journey. Did you raise from angels? Did you think of VC upfront? What was the landscape? Also paint that picture for us.
So we raised money initially because, okay, this is going to take capital to build now, right? Although we still have quite a bit of runway, let's professionalize now and bring in angels and start that journey now because it takes a while, right? So we now happen to have ex-bosses and ex-colleagues and kind of people that were in the industry, knew us, knew what we're doing, knew why the problem was hard and valuable and were willing to put money down. So we managed to get from our network a good enough kind of seed round together pretty quickly.
How soon did you raise the seed round after you started? Immediately.
So from between basically mid 2016, was when we were like, cool, we doubling down on life check. And
1.5 years after. Okay.
So by, till beginning of 2017, we had to close the seed round, 6 months after that. Sorry, so this was the angel round, right? Not the seed round. The seed round came a year after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was with African Rainbow Capital. Yeah.
Now, one thing I'm really curious about is when it comes to consumer businesses, what are some of the key things that you really demonstrated to investors at that time? Because I think that within different markets, it can look very different. And just curious, what were some of the things that you focused on as you led up to that seed round? And then when you crossed the Series A round, again, what are some of the key things that for any founders are building in the consumer face, they should really focus on in trying to portray? I know there's going to be obviously a huge element of the storytelling, the narrative, the vision that you're trying to sell for the future. But just curious, what are the things that you really narrowed in on when you came to those fundraisings?
So I think a lot of investors, when it comes to consumer business, know that consumer is very hard. And most consumer businesses either die or become B2B, right? So they're very aware of that, right? So what you need to convince your investors of is two things, right? And I think the one is, look, you got to convince them that you're solving a really important problem for consumers, right? A problem that is long-standing, perennial, robust, long-existing problem that's not going to go away tomorrow. It's not a fad. It's a real thing, right? It's a hard enough problem that if you make any traction solving it, there's value in that nexus, right? So that has to be a real thing. But the second thing you have to convince them of is that there's optionality in your path, right? In that even if you don't win at consumer, which you probably won't, you can then do other things that create value. So for us, and how that played out in the fullness of time was that a lot of people were skeptical about us succeeding consumer, well, right? But the ones that believe in the optionality in what we're building were also right, right? In that basically we became eventually now the largest advice platform in South Africa with several thousand advisors on the platform, but in a B2B kind of led way with this marketplace approach to it where it's advisors, consumers, and people with market access. Now, when we started that, we had this very consumer-oriented organization with, we're acquiring clients, we're doing all of that. But that was the building blocks. So I think telling the story at that point in that way with the view to really highlighting the optionality in the path, but you also got to do it in a way that you don't sound confused.
Yeah.
In that, we're doing this.
You don't have focus.
you need to make it, the investors must take that conclusion away from just the capabilities that you are building. But there must be conviction in your current path, which at the time we really did. So we sold that. And I think our seed investors bought and said, but the truth is, look, other thing that's worth mentioning in full honesty about early stage fundraising is that they're buying the founder, right? The founders and the team. That's really what it is. So you have to convince them that you are the team to solve this problem. And that even if the problem is going to be hard, even if it's going to take a lot longer, you're still the right team to do it, right? Not that the problem is easy because someone else could do it, or that you've got the tech because that's going to change.
Yeah.
But it's like you're selling the team.
Yeah.
And your relationship with those, having the network, I think, really helps.
Double click on is the fact that you had obviously set out initially to focus on consumers. You obviously said that you tried to, in the narrative, share the fact that there is optionality in the business model to go B2B. But how did you navigate that journey, right? Because I think a lot of consumer founders set out obviously to do consumer. When was it that you had that moment that you realized there's probably a better opportunity here catering to the advisors themselves rather than consumers? And how did you navigate that?
So we started building. So remember, Journey, Dylan and I become financial advisors. We got this thing that customers really, just more people just kept coming. So we got customers sending us referrals because it was a really amazing financial planning experience. We hired advisors, we built teams. We had a Cape Town office, a Joburg office, a Pretoria office. Before we knew it, we had this national retail financial services business
coverage
with real footprint and unit economics are getting there. We raised our seed round from African Rainbow Capital. We extended with Future Growth, was getting there. It was a strange thing that we thought demand side is going to be hard to crack. So we focused so much energy on demand side. And so long as there's demand, we can just keep hiring advisors and keep opening branches and keep. Now, COVID hit. And it became this sort of vibe where all our marketing activity was not moving online and all that sort of stuff. And the shocking part was demand side went through the roof, right? It was, we had 300 $400, $500 leads a month to 4,000, 5,000 in a space of 3 months. And the sort of the biggest problem with product market fit often is finding it. It's when you're not in that, you found it now. And I was like, hey, cool. Customers get it. LifeCheck is the place where you get good financial advice. And now they all want it, but they all want it today. And then it's like, oh crap, we've got 40 advisors. We need
supply.
Yeah. Right. 100 advisors today, right? So that B2B sort of moment was at the same time as that was happening, these advice practices were calling us and, hey, listen, can we use your tech to help cope with, we understand you guys have this tech way of doing things. Can we? And we weirdly, we chased them away. And but listen, we're your competitors. We're getting all your customers right now. So go away and stop coming to us to solve your problems or your problems. But that was the market hitting us in the face to say, listen, here is your product, right? So it took us, I'd say, about 6 months to get the message that, no, the supply side problem we're having and the unsolicited demand from enterprise advisors that we're getting were two sides of the same coin, right? And the strategic solution was, hang on a second, let's just be the platform for everyone to do this thing, as opposed to trying to entirely own the supply side,
yeah, right?
Ourselves, because we just can't scale it quickly enough. We couldn't go from 40 to 200 advisors quickly enough, right? Without saying, no, hang on, advisors, there are customers, there are advisors, there is this platform that makes it all work, right? I'd be lying to you if it was, we went away on a strat session and came back and it was the market beating us over the head the whole time. So this is what you need to be doing. And us being a little bit hard-headed about it and eventually realizing that, oh, hang on a second, this is what we should be doing.
And in retrospect, would you do it? At what point in the journey would you have done it? I know hindsight is 2020, but at what point would you have done it if you could?
So our master plan at the time was, look, we're going to build this advice practice with 30 branches around the country. And then once everyone sees that we're winning, then we'll become this technology business. We'll be the AWS flip up thing where we'll then become the platform and give it to everyone at that point. But it was it was a good plan. I think in hindsight, I probably would have listened quicker to the unsolicited demand that was coming in. So here's a market opportunity. But it's almost impossible when you have conviction in what you're building to change your mind quickly around it. And what I definitely wouldn't have done was start out trying to build a B2B business, because we just would never have had a product that was good enough.
And I also feel the partners would probably push you away, how you were pushing them away, saying that your competition. So it's quite nice that they came eventually, validated the demand early on.
Remember at the beginning, even just finding advisors that would go on the journey with us, right? Why did we become financial advisors? It's because people didn't even want to have the conversation about better advice processes and systems, right? So it was, they pushed us away initially, and then full circle came back and they were, oh, but wait, can we talk? So I don't know that, I think, and that's the weird thing about building business, that you just can't join the dots that way. In that it's not, you can't be like, cool, now that I have the B2B idea, let me go back in time and kind of build this.
Yeah, the market's changed. You've changed. The players have changed. Even the consumer behavior too might evolve. I had a question more around the partnership piece, because I think that acquiring, change, going from a direct-to-consumer model to trying to build tech for this intermediary layer to deploying it, it's almost two different businesses. What were the mental models, both from team, just even customer acquisition? How did you navigate? Any tips that we can share with our listeners and people who are watching?
What I said earlier about, look, you got to be solving a real hard problem, right? To begin with, to have a chance at any of this stuff, I think is really important, because we ended up with a bunch of capabilities that were hard to justify assembling at the time that we needed to make this shift. What was really difficult about making that shift was that we were mid-raise, right? So, with Naspers Foundry, who were in mid-COVID leading our Series A, and we were, okay, cool. So we sold you this whole vision, but this B2B thing, we think we really need to talk about B2B. And they were, so you want to pivot in the middle of DD?
No, right? Oh, wow.
So what happened was we ended up, so they obviously said, listen, you go figure out who you really are and then come back when you're ready. And then our existing investors bridged us while we did the pivot. Now, what that meant was we had to retrench people, right? Because you can't do both. You can't pursue this one vision, but also now you're going to build B2B. A Series A stage startup, mm-hmm. You don't have that kind of resources. Right? So basically, but what we ended up, and here's the interesting part around just how you reorg at that point was that a lot of the financial advisors we had would be great trainers in enterprise for the other financial advisors that we're going to be training. So we ended up using the same people to train. So the 40 advisors we had, we kept enough of them to train the next 2,000 advisors that were going to join our platform. But then we also had a lot of the sort of that kind of go-to-market mindset that you have to develop in a consumer organization to really activate a corporate advisor base to get behind our product. And so there's a lot of unexpected capabilities that you can reframe. You're not going to be able to reuse everything. We had to let people go. But there was a lot of muscles in the organization that we developed that weirdly enough turned into very useful. And it's always that way around. It's consumers harder, right? So going consumer to B2B is, you often have assets that are useful. And then also, I think what was extremely valuable, I'm not sure how to replicate it, but it's, you just have to have, if you're really plugged into your industry, the founding team can are the best place to lead the partnership B2B sales.
So you have to do founder-led sales even at that later stage because you were pivoting the business.
Exactly, right. Just going back to the fact that, look, I was a member of the Old Mutual Exco. I worked with a lot of these people. Mm-hmm. They've all now moved on to other jobs. So I'm not an unknown kind of, not a kind of a start in your garage out of straight out of school kind of vibe. This is an established person in our industry who people know having these conversations. So I think it was starting founder-led sales and then saying who in our sort of B2C sales structure can become. So the guy that ran our advisor sales team then became key account manager, right? So that sort of sales marketing all kind of just translated reasonably well. Your tech team just understand what they're building. And at that point, we had to get really good at product management, right? Because it was when you're doing B2C, you can get away a little bit with just founders in everything. Mm-hmm. But at that point, when you're working with partners, you need to be a lot more disciplined about your product function. So we had to do all those things. But it was really almost like a reset of how the company operates.
Okay. So now you've done this paper, I would love to talk about maybe in retrospect, maybe on the fundraising piece, because I think you just raised a Series A. Is the Series A off the back of this pivot or was it a while back? I would love to kind of place and then maybe lessons on the fundraising piece, because I think to your earlier point on just pivoting mid-fundraise, I just respect the fact that you guys left the fundraise and went and regrouped and got a bridge, because that's hard. You could have been pressured. We're probably going to die if we don't just do this consumer thing long term. So maybe any lessons that we can pick out of that experience would be great.
So Naspers left, look, go figure yourselves out. And then, but when we had proven that, listen, this could be a real force to reckon with as a B2B kind of marketplace, the type of business, they came back, they paid more, they came back, they still led the Series A. And it was also for them, even more confidence in the team that we thought you would die, but it was off. So I think that turned out well in that, obviously, look, we would have died if we hadn't pulled it off. So that was, there's also that. But that, so that was a Series A, and that was, call it 2022. After that, there was a sort of a little bit of an extension of the round as we got really deep into B2B, and now we started to scale. And we kind of got to a place where we got to cash flow profitability from having done B2B really well in the intervening 2-year period that we then didn't need to raise.
Oh, interesting.
And was that an intentional decision? Right? Or because obviously the market went very much from growth at all scale to profitability. Was that an intentional decision or was this just the business?
Unfortunately, while the market was at growth at all costs, we were just trying to survive, right? We weren't part of that whole thing that was happening there of crazy valuations. And so we did our Series A. Look, we kind of benefited from there was more market appetite at the time, but it wasn't a big raise. I think at the time it was $3.5 million. And it was also, okay, we've done it, right, to really turbocharge this thing. So we're very focused on, we already had that discipline of being capital efficient from going into having to survive, walk away from a round and still be able to, you know, get to the next raise. So then I think we just carried on doing that. And then we're like, why do we need to spend money on X? Why do we? And also because of this sort of B2B approach to things was also a really capital efficient kind of way.
Yeah, model. Yeah.
So we did eventually now, look, laterally, we then did a raise. I was actually, funny enough, I was talking to another founder in the ecosystem that did a raise recently that didn't announce. And yeah, fundraising announcements are out of fashion, right? We don't announce
anymore. They're no longer cool. We put our heads down and we build.
Exactly. So we did do what you would call a Series B, but we didn't bother announcing. But that was much more about growth capital at this stage. So it was, how do we expand internationally? How do we deepen our presence in SA? How do we do better entrench our position with our B2B partners that we've got now? And it was much more about, let's double down on this good thing we have, rather than we need to spend money to keep going. So I think listen to the fundraising journey. I think, look, the early stage is a lot about reputation, right? And contacts and networks and people that know you, trust you, etc. That runs out of steam pretty quickly. And then you have to have, look, we have evidence of product market fit and we can scale this thing. A lot of the mistakes I think people make is they treat fundraising as the milestone, right? Okay, now we've raised the money. Great. Celebrate, photo op, champagne. Yeah. That's a mistake, right? It just gets in the wrong mindset.
Yeah.
Exactly. Gets in the wrong mindset, right? So I'm against celebrating fundraising. I'm like, guys, celebrate the real milestones of,
like, yeah,
you know, this is real customer traction. This is what your customers are saying about your product. This is, you're getting close to profitability. These are the milestones that take you closer to independence, right? In the sense, now you're able to build a business that you set out to build in the first place. So I think that's, and if you do that, the fundraising becomes easier when you're just so much more focused on the fundamentals of what you're doing. Yeah. Investors love nothing more than, we don't need to raise, we could talk.
Then they love you. Then they're, we should have a conversation.
You mentioned the growth round. I'm really curious what this next phase of the business looks for you. And also, now that you've obviously been operating this for over 5 years, how have you evolved as a leader over time? And what have you had to almost develop internally within yourself as a business has grown and scaled?
So look, the next phase for us is about really taking a step back to say, how do we build this emerging markets advice tech champion, right? So really, how do we make advisors in emerging markets a lot more productive, and how do we become the best business of this nature in the world? And we've got really good foundation. I think South Africa is a really interesting insurance market in that it's top three in the world in terms of insurance penetration. So after the USA and Thailand, South Africa, and it's got a lot more actuaries per capita than almost any other country, I think any other country in the world. So it's a really concentrated Silicon Valley of insurance is what some people call it, because all the ecosystem is here. So when you start from South Africa and you're building this type of business, you actually have a good shot at building something really interesting on a global scale. There's so many things in insurance that were invented in South Africa and took on the world that a lot of people don't even know started in South Africa. We have that ecosystem as a base, and we're saying, look, how can we really build a world-class business from that base? And which markets, which products, how do we evolve our strategy, et cetera, to try to do that? So that's really what we focus on in the next sort of 3 to 5 years. How have I changed? One is, I'm totally not the same person. In that, you just, look, building a successful career in the corporate world it's a different set of skills, right? In that having developed that set of skills to a hell of a, okay, let me leave that and go right to the bottom again and become a financial advisor and then build. Now I've just got I'm much more of a hands-on builder in almost many respects. I'm a product person now through and through, where I don't think I was before. I thought I was, but you really get to understand it when you go through this. And I think also just much more attuned to the discipline required to survive in the wilderness, right? There are many things that you think are necessary that are not, yeah, right? Whether it's in life or in building a business, right? It's really being able to often go down to the fundamentals of what is really required, right? You're stuck in the desert with a bottle of water, you need to make it across 5 kilometers. What do you really need to take with you? And I think that discipline, that operating discipline, I think is a really key thing. And it makes you a kind of like tougher person. I'm trying hard to not be less compassionate, because that's also a really important aspect of being a builder.
Lose that empathy because you've gone through really hard times yourself.
Yeah. So I think it's those things change you. Also, you just get older and more salty. And
there's stuff that happens now. You're like, we've been through like 5 of those. We'll be fine.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I really wanted to touch on two things. The first was regulation. You are building in a regulated space. Any tips, mentor models that maybe in retrospect you got more clarity or worked at the time? Onboarding this IFA is you having to go be regulated yourself. Any tips would be very interesting for us to hear.
So I think if you're working in a regulated industry, you have to respect that fact very, very deeply. And that there isn't this, look, move fast, break things kind of mindset. The regular system doesn't think that way. If you break one thing, you go to jail kind of thing. You have to understand the regulations deeply enough to be able to innovate, to understand, okay, what is the regulator trying to achieve with something? What's the spirit of the regulation? What is the letter of it? And where is there room for innovation that advances what the regulator is trying to achieve? So I think for us, we've been involved and worked with so many different models of financial advice that ultimately serve the purpose of making good advice more accessible to consumers. And whenever we've had engagements with regulators, they love that fact. And they love the fact we use technology to do it. So it's not to be afraid of the regulations. It's not a barrier. I think regular industries are often the ones that are, I think, safest to innovate in because there's more moat for people that
survive.
Right? and yes, you have to survive in those spaces. Right? So a lot of, we saw startups that, oh, they got traction and then they got shut down because they had the wrong kind of license.
Yeah.
And how do you not have the right license going into a space? You can't. So I think it's that respect for it and seeing regulation as an it's an opportunity to innovate in a way that is safe, but also gives you a moat at the end of it.
Got it. And maybe one more question. This is on competition. So you had the benefit of being a first mover advantage in the industry, but I'm sure as you went in, people started coming behind you. What were the learnings in retrospect? Almost, were you one that kind of looked at competition? Did you not? But any tips on just staying ahead in the industry and securing that position of dominance that you set out with would be useful too.
Yeah. So I think weirdly, at some point you need competition desperately, right? Because especially when you're getting Series A, you need someone else to show your investors that you're not crazy. So we had this thing where we've been going for 3-4 years and investors were like, wait, so why are you the only ones that are doing this? Are you guys smoking something? Why does no one else in this whole industry with all these smart people, why does no one else use this opportunity? And we had, weirdly, one of the large insurers that they initially came and wanted to partner with us, and then they had this idea they'll build their own thing. And it was initially quite annoying, but actually quite useful because we could point to that and be, listen, we're worth copying, right? And that at that point, you need competition to validate there's an industry. You can't be the one doing it forever. If you've picked a hard enough problem where the service area is big enough, does that actually look, if it's a natural monopoly, then congratulations on being first because you'll have, so long as you don't screw it up, the market is yours to win. But if it also isn't, right, then it's also one of those markets where more players creates awareness. Look, we have this thing now where every insurer, banks, financial advice division talks about holistic financial advice. We love it. We were preaching that for a really long time. Now everybody does that marketing work for us, right? So now customers understand that's what you should expect from an advisor. So competition in that sense helps share the marketing cost of customer education, right? And then I think, again, if you're married to the problem and you're really trying to build the best version of the product for your clients, you don't have to worry that much about competition, right? Because all those sort of half-hearted corporate efforts that copying us eventually all sort of fizzled out, right? Because at the end of the day, they're not founders, right? So they're going to get bored or promoted or fail and get promoted. So you won't have to worry about them kind of long-term. So if your thing is meaningful to consumers, you just focus on that. And then I think, if you look at the payment space, the more people that play in payments, the more capital it attracts, the more people believe that it can work. They've seen success stories. It helps, right? So it's a good and a bad thing. I generally think competition is a good thing, just so long as you win.
Yeah. One question I had was just around AI, because I guess 2022 with the advances in AI, that's maybe shaped the way in which you think about how the business can evolve. I'd love to hear your view on what that meant for you as a business, but then also how you see the intersection of AI and financial planning evolving over the next, say, 5 years.
So it's a really interesting question, and I'll try to do it justice in a short space of time. But basically, so AI makes so many more things possible in terms of how people interact with people, right? So just number one, right? Like the confidence that a customer could have to ask whatever question to an advice specialized, financial advice specialized AI that has access to proprietary quotes, APIs, proprietary sort of commercial interfaces that we own, can do a lot more for you than just the generic tools. So we see it as a huge enabler for just broadening the service area of how customers come into the ecosystem, number one. So big opportunity. I think the other thing is the ability to augment productivity. So an advisor now can do so much, right? Because they have, every advisor can have an AI assistant, right? Even the ones that can't afford one, right? Because now they can send you a really well thought out happy birthday message, which they didn't write, right? But you know, oh, wow, I got this from my financial advisor. And I think for us, having come from where we've come from, where we've had this direct consumer DNA, we've got a really good understanding of how can you make this better for the end consumer? And we're very excited about building more and more towards that. But the advantage of being able to sit on the two chairs at once of we've got this view of how it can, you know, really help that end consumer, but also this advisor ecosystem that can be made more productive from it. What that allows you to do is get the best of both worlds. So we can see what a good advisor really do and how can you accelerate and augment that and make the good advisor even better. Then one quick word on the limits of AI. When it comes to regulated industries and industries where basically when something goes wrong, someone needs to be sued. You can't sue the algorithm, right? So you can't be, oh, I asked it to help plan my retirement plan and gave me this advice and now it's all wrong and I'm angry at DeepSeek. So you're going to have this, people at the end of the day want someone who can, who is also capable of suffering. Just if, so if something goes wrong in my finances, I need someone who can suffer.
Yeah, the buck stops at someone. You can hold someone accountable at the end of the day.
And I think the limits of AI is that you can't, you see a lot of AI companies backing away from, ooh, we didn't really write this. This is just a tool for experimentation. It might make mistakes because they're worried about liability. And I think the sort of humanity's last stand when it comes to working with other humans is the fact that we're capable of assuming liability, yeah, right? In a way that a system that can be rebooted, rebuilt, simply just can't, right? And I think that's where the sort of the trust and the skin in the game requirement of the thing that we do. And it's true of doctors, of several other human personal services that are, will be disrupted by AI, but also at the same time have to, they have to adapt to the new world, right? But you're never going to take away that accountability. Look, unless the regulatory regime completely changes and somehow you can sue an AI and AIs can assume kind of legal liability, and we might yet live in that dystopian world, right? But that's going to be less of a technological revolution and much more of a social or political revolution, I think.
Yeah, I know.
We live in interesting times.
We do. Super exciting. No, thank you so much. So one of the things we always ask guests is, retrospectively, if you were to look back on your journey, what would you do differently? What would you tell, you know, Abu starting out all those years ago?
I think a few things, right? So the one is that I probably went through a few sort of iterations of becoming more disciplined around people decisions, around product decisions, etc. And I think I would have probably just trust your instinct more as a founder. And then you just need to realize that, look, you might be wrong, but don't stop moving. Don't die standing still, right? Basically. Just trust your instinct. And if you're wrong, you will figure out and learn and kind of move on quicker. So I'd say it's probably too hesitant at times to do the thing that we knew was the right thing. Looking for too much external validation. Not that you shouldn't, definitely validation matters, but move quicker into the place where you can get validation. The other thing is, I think it's just someone told me something at the time that it was advice that I got from a more experienced founder that I didn't really understand or appreciate until I really understood it and appreciated it was almost too late. Was when you raise money, don't spend it. Only spend the money when you see the metrics move. Mm. So whatever story you pitched and how you're gonna, doesn't mean that you, when the money lands your bank, how you go in. No, there's a separate decision about when to spend the money when you see actual traction. Mm. It's impossible to get younger founders to understand what that really means until you've been through the suffering. But I would urge you to really think about that. Don't spend money, right, until you see things move, right? Until you see evidence that you should spend. You can do a lot without spending, right? So, and I think, look, capital efficiency is fashionable now, right? But I'd argue that it's always been fashionable. We just forget from time to time, yeah, right? What building real business is about. And then probably the last thing I would say is that I think just be very careful with your health. Mm. In that you can't, look, you can lose money, make money, get more money, your health. Yeah. And I think it's very easy to think that, oh, I'm neglecting my health because I'm working so hard. Yeah. Right. No, you can actually be healthy and still work hard. And
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. And then maybe finally, any resources, books, podcasts, resources that have just helped you in your journey?
I've really enjoyed recently listening to the Acquired podcast. They're super long episodes, but they're such good storytellers, right? I think, and they do amazing research, right? In fact, the ones that they don't interview founders where they go do the research and tell a story. I think there's other, look, there's several books that I probably,
Anyone that comes to mind, just one.
I would say that read Marty Kagan's Inspired. It's about building product organizations and the technology product operating model. It changed how I approach building product and just how we organize as a company. That's how we think about that. So I think that's a, I'll tell, yeah, if there was one book I could send back in time, it would be that one.
Love it.
Awesome.
Thank you so
Thanks for
much.
joining us. We've really loved it. Cool.
Absolutely. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Startup Lead, TSL for short. Leave a review, tell us what you think of this episode on all our platforms at the Startup Lead Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guest. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.